wonderful time there with his friends, and he came back and said, we have to do this here in California. So let's organize Estuary West, Thunder Bay West. So this is a slight name change from what we originally envisioned when we asked Catherine and the same speakers to come back here and do a redo here in California. And so I want to welcome you all to this event. And so now it's my job to also let you know that if you bring any coffee into this auditorium, please make sure you have a lid. And if you don't, then Ray Hamas, who is, stand up, Ray, where are you? Ray will distribute lids. And so another thing that I would like to do is to find out who is from where and who came the furthest. Did anybody come further east than New York? Stand up, please. All right. Further east than New York. How much further? Oh, wait a minute. Whole groups are coming in yet. Oh, you guys are going to have to listen to this whole thing all over again. Okay. See, this is what happens when you organize estuary meetings prior to the conference, because these people totally got into it. And estuary is a thing. Yeah, you can sit down. Estuary is a thing that kind of grabs you. It takes you over, and then you end up meeting new people, and you are engrossed in conversation, and time flies when you do that. So we'll give these people a moment to come in. They all love each other right now. You know that. They know each other's first name and where they're from. Are there more groups not yet present and accounted for? All right, Ray, you're in charge of lids. Ray's got lids. He's there, right there at the back. If you don't have a lid on your coffee cup, then please see Ray or raise your hand, and he'll bring you a lid. Okay. Where were we? We were finding out who came the furthest, and we have some people here from east of New York. So, Phil, stand up, and you also, please, stand up. How many, where are you from? Nova Scotia. Boston. Is Boston east of New York? I thought it was north. All right. How about east of Nova Scotia? Anybody here from east of Nova Scotia? From Maine. Okay. How about east of Maine? Anybody east of Maine? What do we got? Wait a minute. Stand up if you're from east of Boston. All right. So where do you guys come from? All right. Anthony? Manchester. Okay. These are the real believers, people. And I want you to know something. These are my ELSNET Estuary small group leaders, and I'm so proud of them. Okay. Speaking of which, will all you ELSNET leaders please stand up? Anybody who's ever been on ELSNET, please stand up. So these are the guys that have learned how to lead a small group online. We do this stuff twice a month, and most of these people that you see here, no, all of them have been part of a group online to learn how to do the estuary protocol, and today they delivered. So if you had a good experience in your small group, give these guys a hand. Thank you. And you'll have more opportunities to do this later on during the course of this event. I don't know what else I was going to talk about. It was all very important, but there's going to be food later on, and I'll say some more about that later, and we'll eat really well here during the course of this weekend. And now I would like to introduce the matron of the Thunder Bay Conference, Consciousness and Conscious Conference, who actually was able to bring these three guys together in a faraway place in the north, someplace in Canada. And so I just decided that if she can do it, then she can do it here as well. So Catherine, will you please join me up here and give a warm hand to Catherine Wilson, and she is. You're going to be in good hands. She's going to take care of the schedule from here on. So thank you.
Thank you, John. Well, I am thrilled to see so many people here. Hello, welcome. I've got a little feedback. Give it a second. We'll see. Better? Okay. Well, I actually won't be up here for long because we actually want Paul to come up, and I will just be hopefully transitioning between things. The big thing is on Discord. Is everybody on Discord? If not, you need to get on Discord. That is going to be our platform for all the Q&A. One of the big things that we're real believers in is the fact that everyone here has a lot to contribute to the conversation that's going to be on the stage. So we really want all of you accessing that platform and then contributing your thoughts, your questions. And my role mostly on stage is to be your voice and sort of offer the questions and comments as they fit into the conversation. So if you can make sure you're on the Discord, I'm just about to make a page that says Q&A. It'll be a new one, and that's just for comments you want delivered on stage or questions for the speakers. So if you can get on that, if you don't have any access and you still want something posted, you can talk to the estuary leaders who are just standing up and they can post something for you. I just volunteered them for that, but I'm sure they're capable. All right. So for those of you who do not know Paul Vanderclay, yeah? Tim, is there Wi-Fi? Yes, there is. It's an open network, so you're good. All right. Any more questions, and we can field them at the back about the Wi-Fi. So Reverend Paul Vanderclay is a Dutch Reformed pastor who served as a missionary in the Dominican Republic for several years before taking the call as a pastor in Sacramento, California. Reverend Vanderclay is known for his deep engagement with culture, philosophy, and theology, and intense interest in people and how contemporary expressions of perennial issues impact them. Come on up, Paul.
I am tremendously excited for the time we're going to have together. I have been looking forward to this for a long time. The place that we are in is important. For many of you, you're just coming in here, it's a different place, but this building, this congregation, this people here, this is a spiritual home for a few hundred people. And it's connected with other spiritual homes in North America that are connected to other spiritual homes all around the world. And so to have this here, I think, is a very big deal. Now, I'm going to have some slides, and I'm going to try and get this done on time. I'm going to warn you, there's more information in here than I'm going to be able to deliver in 40 minutes. I'm going to really hit my mark. I know I usually have 2 hours plus on YouTube, but I'm going to do my best. And I'm going to make the PowerPoint available on the Discord, so if I don't read through everything and you say, oh, you went through the slides fast, you can look it up on the Discord and you can read it online and you can take it home, beg, borrow, steal it, I don't care. As a pastor, I always see people are on a quest for a spiritual home, even if they don't use those words. And it is all the time. And they do it in all sorts of different ways. What do I mean by spiritual? I've got a Peugeotian sense. Is that a word, Peugeotian? Is that what we're saying now, Jonathan? It is now. What do I mean by spiritual? In a Peugeotian sense, to participate in the deep perennial shalomic patterns. Shalomic is of shalom, that great Hebrew word. To participate in the deep perennial shalomic patterns that are beneath the instantiations. And again, I know for some of you, some of the words we're using, Justin is going to be, Justin, where are you, Justin? Are you here right now? Justin's got his hands up. He's going to be taking video. He wants to do like a 10-minute on-ramp documentary for people to figure out what on earth they are doing. Even the people of the church are like, what's this conference about? So perennial shalomic patterns beneath the instantiations. And for John, and after Socrates, kind of a Platonic sense, which is also, C.S. Lewis was in very many ways a popularizer of a lot of Plato. To participate in the unseen beneath the decaying instances as we move from childhood through adulthood to death in this world. So the order of work I'm going to do here, some common quests using popular poets, seeing the Bible through this lens. I think one of the real issues we're going to deal with in the next 50 years will be how modernity both achieved relief and groomed us for weakness of agapic muscle, leading to a frustrating realization about the capacity. Now, when I say dispensation, I don't mean that in the dispensationalist sense, just in terms of this realm of being we are currently in. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the primary capacity we need that this quest requires. And then I'm going to have some points for further dialogos and, again, the PowerPoint available. So the first poet is Bruce Springsteen, 1980. Everybody Has a Hungry Heart. And for a lot of these songs, I actually made a playlist, and Tim is playing it in the hall. Got a wife and kids in Baltimore, Jack. Went for a ride, and I never went back. Like a river that don't know where it's flowing, I took the wrong turn, and I just kept going. Everybody's got a hungry heart. Lay down your money and you play your part. Everybody's got a hungry heart. I met her in a Kingstown bar. We fell in love and I knew it had to end. We took what we had and we ripped it apart. And now I'm down here in Kingstown again. Everybody's got a hungry heart. And then the last sense, these words will come up. You'll be surprised when and where they do, but they're always found with the quest for home. Is rest. Everybody needs a place to rest. Everybody wants to have a home. Don't make no difference what nobody says. Ain't nobody like to be alone. Hungry Heart comes from Tennyson, his poem Ulysses, where he imagines Ulysses coming back after the whole Odyssey thing, settling back down in Ithaca, and he's restless. It was Rick. Where's Rick? Rick is real. He is in. We thought of giving him a name tag that said Chad the Alcoholic, just for throw everybody off. But Rick introduced me to the South Park member berries, and you can just imagine Odysseus in Ithaca. Remember Scylla and Charybdis? Remember Troy? Remember? You know, it's like another Bruce Springsteen song about that baseball player who sort of reached his peak in high school, and every time he's in a bar, he talks about that high school game where he struck everybody out. Ecclesiastes 3 says, God has placed eternity in our hearts. It's such a haunting phrase. And I think it's that eternity that makes us restless. We look for a home and we find it and we blow it up. We long for a home, and after we've blown it up, we lament the home we've lost and we blame someone else for blowing it up. When death is stalking us in a secular age, we're anxiously racing to achieve. When death isn't stalking us, we're on a spiritual quest where our grasp continues to be just beyond our reach. Some of you have Paul visited Joshua Tree, YouTube's great album, The Joshua Tree. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Probably just saying those words triggers that anthem. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. So we have the four P's of knowledge. I'm giving you the four P's of questing for a spiritual home: person, people, place, permanence. The four P's of questing. We have the romantic quest, the family quest. Home is fundamentally relational, so God number two. Home is always arenic, so God number one. God as fellow quester and destination. We'll see that in the resurrection and the personal agent. When Billy Joel released, now we're getting back to my childhood, when Billy Joel released Piano Man, which was a song everybody knows, probably his most beautiful romantic song, You're My Home. Home can be the Pennsylvania Turnpike, Indiana's early morning dew, high up in the hills of California. Home is just another word for you. Well, I've never had a place that I can call my very own, but that's all right, my love, because you're my home. If I travel all my life and I never get to stop and settle down, as long as I have you by my side, and there's a roof above and good walls all around. You're my castle, you're my cabin, you're my instant pleasure dome. I need you in my house, because you're my home. 10 years later, Dan Fogelberg, with his greatest hits album, would put out a song, a new one, Make Love Stay. Now that we love, now that the lonely nights are over, how can we make love stay? Now that we know the fire can burn bright or merely smolder, how can we keep it from dying away? Elusive as dreams, barely remembered in the morning, love like a phantom flies. But held in the heart, it pales like the empty smile adorning a statue with sightless eyes. Fogelberg was born in 51. He died of cancer in 2007. Was married 3 times. Moments fleet, taste sweet within the rapture when precious flesh is greedily consumed. What a great description of Eros. But mystery's a thing not easily captured, and once deceased, not easily exhumed. Now that we love, now that the lonely nights are over, how can we make love stay? Billy Joel had at least 4 homes. His starter wife, the it girl of the 1980s, Christie Brinkley, a woman who was famous for having a cooking show, and then that look of his with his very youthful bride sort of says it all. You're my home. No, you're my home. No, you're my home. Abraham, family is everything. The one man in the ancient world really seemed to love his wife, didn't take another. Everyone around him simply dreams of beating the age of decay with family and hereditary, and he can't seem to have a child. And God comes to him and offers him everything. You're going to be the father of nations. This is his dream come true. And then it doesn't happen. And so that whole section in the book of Genesis is Abraham questing for a spiritual home. Leave the land of your father. Go to a land that I will show you. I'm going to give you descendants, family, lands, everything. 25 years until finally Isaac comes. Ishmael? No, not him. Your servant? Lot? No, not him. Sarah? I'm going to have a baby? Why did you laugh? Because it's hilarious. We're going to name the kid that. Take your son, your only son, to a mountain I'm going to show you and offer him as a sacrifice. Now I know, Abraham, that you trust me. Biblical family values are strange. Cain kills brother Abel and, like his parents, are cast from God's presence. You will be a restless wanderer over the earth, God says to Cain. And then Cain complains, I will be a restless wanderer over the earth. Repeats the phrase. Noah, the best man in the world, family man, who alone with his family curses his son. Leah and Rachel are rivals for their husband's love through producing sons, and it will result in selling brother Joseph into slavery because brother Judah explains, you know, there's really no money in murder. The Bible has a long list of disastrous parenting. Isaac and Rebekah nearly lose Jacob to Esau and to brother-in-law Laban. Moses, Samuel, and Eli's sons are worthless. David, the man after God's own heart, who's promised an eternal dynasty, is one of the Bible's worst fathers. Ammon rapes half-sister Tamar, and Absalom kills him, and Absalom starts an absolutely bloody civil war. And David seems hapless in the front of all of the calamity. Jephthah, the judge, of course, sacrifices his daughter. One of the shining lights in the Bible in the time of the judges is Ruth. Naomi, with a husband and two sons, leaves the house of bread, Bethlehem, with their family to go to Moab because of a famine. Naomi means sweetie, but then when the husband dies and the sons all die in Moab, first she's a refugee from lack of bread and the house of bread going to Moab, then she's a refugee from death in Moab, comes back home to Bethlehem, and she tells everyone, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because what? Who? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. But in Moab, of course, has those hot women that are always sort of tempting the Israelite men. Naomi says to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. Watch the language again. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Notice she sends them back to the home of their mothers, but you're going to need a husband. May you find rest in the home of your husband. You didn't find it in the home of my son. Then she kissed them goodbye and wept aloud. And in Ruth's most famous speech, she perfectly reveals the agapic path in this quest for a spiritual home. At this, they wept aloud. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. Orpah, of course, Oprah is named after her. They mixed up the letters. But Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is doing the smart thing. She's going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn my back from you, to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May that Lord, the Lord Naomi is about to say such strong things about, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. And then Naomi sort of sighs and gives up. C.S. Lewis, in this quote that you've heard me use a lot, the Christian doctrine of suffering explains, I believe, a very curious fact of the world that we live in, the age of decay. The settled happiness and security that we all desire, God withholds from us. God withholds from us by the very nature of the world. But joy, pleasure, and merriment, he scatters broadcast. We are never safe, but we have plenty of fun and some ecstasy. It's not hard to see why. The security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world, and oppose an obstacle to our return to God. A few moments of happy love, a landscape, a symphony, a merry meeting with our friends, a bath, or a football match have no such tendency. Our Father refreshes us on the journey with some pleasant inns, not homes, but will not encourage us to mistake them from home. Now, especially in this group with Orthodox and Protestants and all of our chatter between us, modernity is to blame. Because in modernity, We took matters into our own hands. We secured for ourselves the solutions to the material inequalities that drove Naomi out from Bethlehem. These material insecurities that we've suffered from forever. Want, hunger, deprivation. If we could be free from material want, then we could fill the ache that eternity leaves in our hearts. We've been dramatically successful with this. Look at this room we're sitting in. Unbelievable. Modernity has also brought, however, an intensification of the domicide as our agapic muscles weakened. I think I will have time to read this. I read it on my channel. It's haunting. Andrew Root. I was sitting in a window seat on Northwest flight from Los Angeles to Minneapolis. My anxiety higher than the plane's altitude. As we flew over the deserts of Nevada, my eyes focusing on the mountains set against the backdrop of a pink-hued sky, I thought to myself, I hope the plane goes down. The thought of the plane hurling towards the desert floor and crashing into a ball of fire was more appealing than what awaited me in Minneapolis. The plane didn't crash. But as I trudged towards the baggage claim, fear gripped me. I found myself noticing the emergency exits, wondering what would happen if I ran through one, contemplating how I could sneak onto a flight to Beijing. I got on the escalator down to the baggage claim, knowing it would deliver me to my nightmare. As the escalator dropped me onto the baggage claim floor and I walked closer, I could feel every muscle in my neck and back tightening. My heart started to race. My legs felt heavy. My mouth went dry. And then my nightmare piped out, "Welcome home. We're glad to see you." I thought home was everything. It was my parents. The nightmare had actually started 6 months earlier. Last time I had been in Minneapolis had been Christmas. During 2 weeks home, my girlfriend and I, two graduate students, decided that we would get married. We excitedly told both of our families, then received words of encouragement and good wishes. Flying back to Los Angeles, passing over the same mountains I would cross with dread months later, I eagerly anticipated my future. When the automatic exit doors slid open at LAX and the warm Southern California hit my body, some of you know exactly what he's talking about, I felt whole, happy, and hopeful. But on a cold, rainy LA night, this all changed. I returned home from a late night class and found a frantic voicemail from my fiance. I raced to her apartment where she was curled on the bed, sobbing. Her mother had caught her father, who had been her hero, with inappropriate and illicit material on his computer, including love letters to and from another woman. Just as our own was months of starting, her parents' marriage was over. The grief consumed our lives. The loss of her parents' marriage seemed to be affecting my fiancé from the inside out. At 23, Kara found herself questioning who she was and where she belonged. These were not simply questions of social location. Where will we spend Christmas? What about the house we grew up in? Although those thoughts were painful in their own right, hers were more distressing questions. They were existential. She seemed to come from the core of her being. In the middle of many nights, she would call me, awakened from a deep sleep and a state of terror. Kara felt as if the split in her parents' marriage had become a split in her own being. I have to start over again. I mean, seriously, who am I? She stated repeatedly. It was Memorial Day when her questions became my own. We had returned from Kansas City where Kara's sister had just gotten married. It was the first time that Kara had seen her father since her parents' breakup. Thoughts of seeing him paralyzed her for weeks. But as painful as it was, we had survived. I sat down to work on a paper when the phone rang. It was my father. Since it was a holiday, I wasn't surprised to hear from him. He began asking how I was, and I thought we were easing into a routine conversation. With this in mind, I rehearsed recent small events, then I returned the softball question of my own. And what's going on there? A lot, actually, he said. For the next 20 minutes, my father explained that my mother was having an affair and that he'd had his own in years of their marriage. He explained that they didn't know what was next, but he wanted me to be aware. In the phone calls over the following days, my parents assured me that they were going to work through this, that they were going to try to save their marriage. I doubted them from the start. I'd never been privy to the many specifics, but I had known for years that their marriage was anything but solid. Now, hearing of their infidelity, I, like Kara, felt as if I were sucked into a dark pit. In a real sense, I started to wonder who I was, to question whether my very existence rested on anything solid at all. I couldn't help but feel that their actions attacked me, the core of my person. After all, I was the product, quite literally, of their love and commitment. I came into being out of their union, their mutual desire that created a community called parents to love and care for me, a home. I existed because of their choice, and now they were choosing to destroy the very communion that made me. Their disunion threatened me nothing less than ontologically. It was to say that it shook my very being and existence. John mentioned Mary Eberstadt in the little warm-up video that we did, how the West really lost God, and Mary in that book keeps going back to the family factor. Trends associated with family decline accompany religious decline. The most irreligious parts of the West have the smallest, weakest, fewest natural families, and vice versa. Family boomlets accompany religious boomlets. You can blame industrialization, modernity, and even Protestantism. But if you read Emma Griffith's Liberty Dawn, which is basically an accumulation of biographies and diaries during the Industrial Revolution, the history is way more complex. We look at life on the farm and we think, oh, it looks lovely, but none of you have ever worked a 17th century farm. There was hunger, there was deprivation, there was brutality. People eagerly went to the city and they looked at Dickens' London and said, it's an upgrade to starving. Just look at all the pictures from the American southern border now. These people are coming from the places Americans go to vacation. It seems what we really want is scenery plus snack. Now, the Bible, in some ways, is the story of God's quest for a spiritual home, not only ours. John Walton, in his book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, notes that temples are places where deity rests. It's the definition of a temple. In Genesis 1, despite all the fighting over 6 days or this and that, Genesis 1 is a temple text where God establishes a temple. And then in Genesis 2, he makes the man and we live in the backyard. Or the garden. Rest is the initiation of meaningful participation. What does divine rest entail? Most of us think of rest as disengagement from the cares, worries about life. What comes to mind is sleeping in or taking an afternoon nap, right, Jared? But the ancient world rests on what results when a crisis has been resolved and when the stability has been achieved, when things settle down. Consequently, normal routines can be established and enjoyed. For deity, this means that the normal operations of the cosmos can be undertaken. And again, Genesis 2, what are we made of? We are the stuff of earth and the breath of heaven. Earth can't be fulfilled without our work. We are tied to the land because we are made of it and we are made from it. In life, we create fruitful engagement with it, and in death, we return to it. Now, what's amazing about God, God number one and God number two, is the wrath of God. God is homebreaker. When Naomi complains, she's right. God has done this to her. Well, what do you mean? God number one, God number two, was it intentional? It's the wrath of God. God is both homebreaker and home promiser. God keeps exiling humanity because of our rebellion, but never completely forsaking us. The man and the woman are cast out. There's frustration in the field and frustration in the birth canal, but we're given garments of skin. Cain is cast out from God's presence, but God says, I'll give you my mark, and he becomes a city builder. God undoes Genesis 1 in the flood, but preserves Noah. Noah produces in the field, but curses his son. Babel is rival to God. He frustrates it, but makes them fruitful in the way they were originally designed to be. Walter Brueggemann in the 70s wrote a book on all of the landedness of the Bible entitled The Land. Can humanity and God actually share a home? All those desert wanderings, all the ups and downs, the big fights between Father God and Mama Noah, or not Noah, but Moses. You know, I'm sick of these people. I'm going to kill them. No, don't kill them. I'm tired of these people. Why did you take me? Oh, Moses, settle down. Back and forth they go, trying to keep the home together. The Sinai and desert wanderings are in some ways a betrothal, but the marriage was off to a rocky start. They're looking for the land of rest, the house of rest. God keeps telling them, be careful, the land will vomit you out. Israel will go into exile within the land. Babylon will destroy the temple and exile the people in a more formal way. In diaspora, Israel, like Abraham, will sojourn. But the sojourning Son of Man that we meet in Jesus is questing like his father, and he embraces a homelessness in the age of decay. As they were walking along the road, a man said to them, I will follow you wherever you go. That's like, Pastor, if I lived in Sacramento, I'd go to your church. You probably wouldn't. Jesus replies, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man, that heroic emperor from Daniel 7, has no place to lay his head. Herod, when he says, why a fox? Well, fox was Herod. Herod's building palaces, Masada, palaces all over the place. Herod has palaces. Rome, that eagle, that standard on top of the pole that the imperial troops walk through your cities to demonstrate, they have perches. Herod has dens, but this emperor of the world from Daniel 7 doesn't have a palace here. Jesus is in exile with Israel. The resurrection will, of course, be vindication of agapic love as resolution to the age of decay and the domicide it reliably produces. The declaration that creation 1.0 is insufficient to finally afford the housing our eternity-laden hearts hope for. The emerging age still comes within the age of decay. The ascension is, in many ways, redomestication, but it's still incomplete. It's awaiting the final movement. And the final movement you, of course, find in Revelation 21, where both God and humanity achieve the spiritual home they have been questing for. Then I saw a new heavens and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. Joe and I can talk about that. I don't know if we'll ever figure that one out. Chaos, yeah, I get it, but I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride. Notice how all these things come together. Prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them." The difficult marriage in the wilderness finally finds its home of rest. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and will be their God. He will no longer be the divine homewrecker he has been throughout the story. He will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Agape has always been the path to home. Now, Eros might launch us there, but it can't be held without agape. Now, the achievements of the pre-modern world, there was an understanding of the pursuit of the patterns through the instantiations. And I think part of what this moment with respect to pre-modernity and modernity, how all of this works, is sort of a realization that, oh yeah, we've achieved a lot in modernity, but those medievals and those ancients, well, they knew something we seem to have forgotten. The acceptance of suffering that afforded building agapic muscle and capacity was absolutely important, along in many ways with the want. Many marriages have endured tough times because they just couldn't afford to divorce. Billy Joel, he always had the money. When people were stuck, and this is cruciformity because you are, of course, stuck on a cross. That's the purpose of the nails. The patterns beneath were revealed, and it offered goods that our technological, transactional hearts fail to achieve when we have options. When I lived in the Dominican Republic, and I'd shake hands with those Haitians that lived that hard, hunger-filled life. They had bodies Americans would love to achieve and never do, all because of want and hard work, and they tended to die young too. We've achieved a lot of good, but have lost other deeper things in the process. All right, good. Got some time for my dialogos points. Secularity is the secret sister of the modern church. In many ways, what's so fun about this weekend is we are in some ways sort of an archetypal Protestant seeker auditorium. When Bill Hybels launched the seeker revolution, don't call it a sanctuary. And if you walk in the room, you can do anything in this room, right? It's plain. Now when we go to the Orthodox Church, whoosh, it's going to be the opposite end, won't it? Secularity, the secret sister of the modern church, nudged us towards a meta-divine realm neo-paganism. Everybody always wants to know God number one and God number two. Okay, here it is. God number one, the arena quality of the revolutionary Hebrew monotheism and modernity was exchanged for a sort of deism, a disenchantment. This accentuated God number two. The agentic relational qualities of God, of the Bible, became magic. Now suddenly, instead of when you're dealing with another person, what everybody wants pastors to do in a normal church is to control the other people. What nobody wants in a church is to be controlled, which I think is why in modernity, suddenly churches, both Pentecostal and Orthodox, that have all of this, can't forget the Roman Catholics, that have all of this submission that keeps poor Father Eric where the snow flies freely and the sun doesn't shine, right? Suddenly, this weird thing happens in modernity now where we have these totalizing institutions where God must be God over all the tiny details, and any misfortune must somehow fit into a machine imagination. And what I think is happening in this little corner and through our dialogues is we're rebalancing God as spiritual home, both arenic and agentic, to address this hunger. Second point, home as rest. You can find it in Bruce Springsteen, you can find it in Billy Joel, you can find it in the Bible, figuring out what we mean by rest. Because rest isn't just a Sunday afternoon nap. The seventh day has been continued to morph. Resolution of the biblical narrative is tied deeply to what exactly is our posture of rest. Ironically, for many of us, for me, you know, my wife is like, well, what happens when we retire? Are you going to still do videos? I like doing videos. Videos are therapy for me. Even the Son of Man finds no rest before his ascension. Cain is a restless wanderer. Abraham in Hebrews 11 is longing for a heavenly city. Demonstrable sentness and cruciformity, the productivity of it in the apostolic church is what we see. Churches are not at rest. Every church wants to say, this is your home of rest. And then you get into a church and you realize, oh, wow. Sometimes, maybe. But other times, it's struggle, and it's combat, and it's relational instability. People could more easily accept a cruciform, iconic church before the grooming of the expectations of techne. Part of the reason of mass disappointment with church is they expected it to be fulfilled land of rest, and it never is. That's why I say, yeah, if you lived in Sacramento, you might not stay at Living Stones, although hats off to our couple here that drives in from Berkeley. I don't see you, but I know you're in the room. The third thing, when John talked about the horizontal in our warm-ups, this gets into the inexhaustible God, both arenic and agentic. And it's also embodied in the parent-husband we don't exhaust. It's like somebody comes in and says, I'm bored with my spouse. Good. Well, you're finally starting to see something in the marriage. Because boredom is probably the first honest moment where you might actually discover something beyond the stuff you've been projecting upon them. Home that remains provokingly challenging and the initiation of rest for eternity. It's finally an Ithaca where Ulysses can rest. It's finally the place Abraham longed for but never saw. And in that way, it has to be inexhaustible, or we will simply get bored, smash it, and look for another. I'm 32 seconds over, so mission accomplished.
Thank you, Paul. We have 10 minutes. Take a break, get a coffee, come back, and then we will hear from Jonathan.